trends.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapult the propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
Everything you think you know about history is probably wrong. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. We're finishing up our exclusive series of interviews recorded at the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference in July with a couple of men who have dug deep into history and come back with evidence that perhaps it's not as we thought it was. We're proud to bring you these concluding interviews as we prepare for the release of the DVD set from the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference, L.A. Marzulli, and we begin with a fascinating conversation with Stan Deo.
Probably one of the most anticipated presentations at the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference coming from our guest now. He had jaws on the floor 2 years ago with his presentation on the location of Eden, and he is back here today, this weekend, with another one that is sure to be a showstopper. He's worn many hats in his life, everything from undercover work for the FBI to working on flying saucer technology, Black Project with Dr. Edward Teller. If you're into ufology, you know who that is. Today, or this weekend, he's talking on the perils of prophecy and the Atlantean Antichrist. We welcome Stan Deo to the conference.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, we always enjoy talking with you and Holly, Sharon, and me, and it's always a fascinating conversation. And I am looking forward to your presentation tomorrow on the Atlantean Antichrist.
Well, thank you for that. We enjoyed breakfast with you guys the other morning, too, sharing from what you had and how much of it dovetails into what we've just met.
It is surprising. We start talking with the various speakers here how much of what people are bringing to the table overlaps, almost as though God had a plan. Well, let's talk about the presentation you gave here last night on the perils of prophecy. And we're told
it's actually prophetic perils.
Prophetic perils. Okay.
Yeah, because it kind of connotes the wrong thing the other way around. But Holly has been working for a year and a half combining all of the events that fit end time prophecy to be fulfilled. And I watched her doing that, and I was doing my thing, working research, and I'd look across the office and she'd say, "Oh, I found this," and I'd say, "Oh yeah, I saw that in the news." But when she put it all into the book and I read it and edited it, put it to print, I saw all of it gathered together, and it was overwhelming, the evidence that we're in the last days. And that's why it's prophetic perils, and then why she says in the 20th chapter, here's the good news.
That is, I think, something that we can too easily overlook. Joseph Farah was talking about that earlier today, in fact. His presentation is on what our ultimate goal is, where, you know, we Christians tend to focus on what is in between us and that ultimate goal, which is being restored into the holy family, God's family, on his holy mountain when he sets up his kingdom here on earth. But between now and then, we know that there will be some troublesome times, and that we get preoccupied maybe with figuring out who the Antichrist is, or who is Gog of Magog, or what nation will birth the Antichrist. The good news, just talk on that for a minute. You know,
well, the good news is, of course, as you said, that the good Lord is coming, and he will, in my opinion, rapture his bride out early in the tribulation period, if not before it starts. But the good news is that even after the church is gone, there will be a witness across the earth and options for people who are going to be in the middle of the terrors of the tribulation period and the judgments. You know, I think, from what you said, that we need to concentrate on gathering the potentials. Okay, is it Gog Magog? Is it Psalm 83? Bring them into consciousness and watch the news, because it's happening so quick that, what time is it? You know, that something else is fulfilling prophecy. And certainly, Holly and I are this way. We've talked to a lot of the other speakers here and guests. They say, do you believe in a pre-trib rapture? Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's the way it is, but I'm willing to be proved wrong, and no big deal. What about the Gog Magog? Well, we think it's this way, but hey, what's your opinion? Mm-hmm. And it's sharing and opening up our mind to be aware of what things fit the pattern. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so great that God put that through the prophet so that we can do that now. And it's been kept kind of a secret for all these generations until now. Mm-hmm. And that's the good news, is that we're going to know what's happening, and be able to share that with folks around us for a while.
That's right. Jesus told us there is a great deception coming that would fool even the elect if it were possible.
That's the deal.
If it were possible.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the big presentation tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Atlantean Antichrist. Just the title alone is very compelling. What has your research found? What were you digging on? Now, bear in mind, this won't see the light of day until October, so this isn't going to tip anything before people...
Oh, yeah. I've already been kind of talking with Hagman and Hagman on the show as I discovered these things, or as the Lord led me to discover it, I think is probably the better thing. When Bob Ulrich said to me in January, look, you want to come speak here at the conference? And I said, oh, well, yeah, I guess I can. I can update on the Garden of Eden findings, but I don't have anything else to talk about, you know. I really didn't think so. And he said, look, the Lord will find something for you. We'll put you down and, you know, get to work. So a few weeks passed, and I was looking through the old Garden of Eden notes I did for the last lecture, and I stumbled on some of my older notes from 1989 from the Vindicator Scrolls about Atlantis. I thought, Atlantis. Well, I'll find that someday. You know, I've worked on it. And then I was looking at the meteor that I said caused the flood, and it was the Chicxulub meteor hitting into the Gulf of Mexico. And I was wrong. I realized I was wrong because there wasn't enough energy in that impact to affect the other side of the Earth. So I went back over into the Indian Ocean and started looking for what could have caused it. And I found a NASA publication showing a 6 million square mile gouge in the surface of the Earth there, in a bowl shape, underneath where India used to be before it was kicked up into the Himalayas. I thought, what can cause that? And so I started looking and couldn't find anything. It's got to be something big hit there, because not only a gouge here, it shoved up a bunch of seabed mass under New Guinea and Indonesia and formed the Banda Sea.
Okay.
It raised it up about another 6 million square miles over here. So it shoved it out over there. So I was looking for something that hit and went that way. And I read in India, I was thinking maybe it's something in India, that they have something called the Kudapa Basin on the east coast. Roughly 250-mile diameter ring, just a portion of it is on the shore. And the scientists in India are saying, look, this has to be a large meteoroid, but we can't find the impact. So then I started looking, because I knew that India, the surface of India, had been shoved up into the Himalayas. Mm-hmm. I looked down where it used to be, and I found that the impact area was covered over by landfall from Sri Lanka and the tip of India. It fell into the crater.
Hmm.
And then, of course, I started to put pieces together and talk to the oil companies, and I found out that it hit like this, but the backwash flew over Saudi Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula, and it deposited... seabed, mantle, 3,000 meters deep. 3,000
meters deep.
And it sunk that part of Arabia and lifted up the other part over in the Mediterranean and stopped the flow of water that had gone around there. And suddenly, I realized, wait, there's more.
So the Mediterranean at one time connected into the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean and...
Yeah. In a big way.
So the Levant basically was shoved up there when all of this hit?
Well, the connection went through Turkey-Syria border,
yeah.
Went down like this into the Babylonian, you know, the Euphrates, Tigris Valley. And it was a long channel with islands right through the Persian Gulf and out into the Indian Ocean.
Wow.
When I saw that, I thought, wait a minute. Plato wrote about Atlantis, an island. But there were two islands, the main island and the small one. Well, how big was that main island? And I found out it was about 1.3 million square miles. I said, well, that's not a little tiny island. But the island itself was only, you know, like about, out to the outer rim, about 11 miles in diameter. So then I went to NASA and I said, look, can I have a high-resolution 3D imagery, the best you've got, of the Arabian Peninsula and the Persian Gulf? And when they sent that to me, I put on the glasses and looked at it, and sure enough, there was an 11-mile diameter set of rings on the east coast of Arabia, which is on the west coast of the Persian Gulf. And that's Damam, the D-A-M-M-A-M island, where they first discovered oil for Saudi Arabia. That's where they got rich, was there on the top of what was Poseidon's Island. Once I found that, then I started looking for the fertile plain that Plato described, and the coastline in between Libya and Asia Minor, compared to coastlines, compared to areas, everything fit. Then I started like 1,400 artifacts. I found stone things that were big, hundreds of feet long. And I found that they all represented the channel that was cut from the land at that time, from the mainland of Atlantis, into the Poseidon's Island to where the circles were for where he dwelt with his wife. When I shrunk those down, just scaled them down to look and see what those symbols looked like, those keystone formations, those 1,400 formations, were identical scale models of Atlantis Island, of the Poseidon's Island.
Huh.
And that explains Gilgal circles. That explains Stonehenge. It explains what the Aztecs have on their carving.
Trying to recreate that.
They all were remembering where Poseidon lived.
Wow. Now, at Cahokia, there's a wood henge where archaeologists have found the remains in the earth of what would have been a wooden circle.
This is where it came from, was the circles of Poseidon. And there's so much. I mean, I even found a pyramid in the middle of it's just north of the Rub al-Khali, the empty quarter. And it's a shallow pyramid, flat. And on the top of it are the stone circles, again.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are four ridges that come out, straight line ridges. And I flew around this in the presentation to show people that it is a flat pyramid.
Wow.
And nobody's ever, as far as I know, nobody's ever put that together, but it is there.
And a flat pyramid, you mean like a ziggurat, the old Babylonian?
Well, it could have been a ziggurat. It was, if you look at the whole pyramid, it was like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a little stone circle on the top of it in the middle. But there were these four arms, and they kind of came out a little bit not perfect,
mm-hmm.
They were definitely artificial.
Hmm.
And, you know, we found in the Greek records where they said that the sons of Poseidon lived in a place called Gadarius after one of the twin sons of Poseidon. Well, today, there is still a location that the Greek Decapolis cities used called Gades from Gadaria, and it's over close enough to the Sea of Galilee and to where the giants lived in Og and Bashan. I mean, it's within spitting distance. That is where he lived. And it said he took his home toward the gates of Heracles or Hercules,
yeah.
Right? We found those gates. That's not the Rock of Gibraltar. It's the gates that used to be a port, a seaport, the Greeks even used for a while. And then, like in the time of Alexander the Great. And it's on the border between Turkey and Syria, right there at the Mediterranean.
Hmm.
And I made a graphic. I can't show the video because there just wasn't enough time. But I sailed through there. I put the water levels right, and I sailed through the Straits of Hercules and over into Atlantis. It's just,
wow.
Amazing
now,
stuff.
Now, that city, in fact, I remember you mentioned that this morning, and I meant to ask you about that Gadarius, but near the Sea of Galilee. Gadarius, was that correct?
Gades.
Gades.
No, but it was after the sun that was called Gadarius.
But that was the spot where Jesus then confronted the Gadarene demoniac, the one who said, we are called legion, for we are many?
Yes. Yes, that's true.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, see, now you see why we enjoy talking to each other, because we were doing this all through breakfast. And,
I know. It's hard to get something down, wasn't it?
Well, this is fascinating. So this would have been destroyed then. Atlantis would have been destroyed as part of
the flood? Let me tell you something. This means, by implication, that Noah was an Atlantean citizen.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird? But all of the people around him were of the bad gene pool. Their generations weren't perfect, in other words.
Right, right.
And they were killed for crossbreeding with animals and all the stuff they were doing, the nonsense and the giants and all the illegal breeding. They were killed. That was Atlantis. And when a meteoroid that size hits, it breaks up the mantle.
Mm-hmm.
And the fountains of the deep gush up with hot water, which the Hebrew accounts tell you that water that rose up after the rain stopped was from hot subterranean sources. In the Moho discontinuity, we call it today. The impact pushed up so much steam that it condensed in the upper atmosphere and contributed to the rain,
fellas,
collapsing canopy.
Hmm.
So it all fits. Yeah, it's just, once you put that all together, then you realize, well, gosh, that was only about 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. But yet they say that, the continents didn't split apart until 100 million years ago. Something is wrong with traditional or secular timing of age, and
mm-hmm.
we did find that era. In the speed of light, and that's being investigated now and put forward by several groups, mathematical teams, who are saying we have a young universe because if we accept the Big Bang, that the Earth was, or sorry, that the universe was all crammed down into this teacup-sized thing,
mm-hmm.
it was very dense. So light waves, electromagnetic waves, traveled a lot faster. How much faster? 10 with 60 zeros behind it faster. When that happens, then radiometric dating that we use for radiocarbon dating
mm-hmm.
is all up the chute.
Right.
You have to apply an exponential curve that looks like that, and we're down here in this part here.
Yeah.
Where light is still slowing down, but not like it did in the beginning. So we can safely say that the entire universe could be only 100,000 years old, which lends credence to the fact that we are in avatars in a holographic or you know, the creation of the computer.
Right, the kind of thing that Chuck Missler, Josh Peck have talked about. And in fact, I've talked to a physicist who's doing that research on the changing speed of light.
Right.
And it you know, again, it beyond my capacity for physics, but it makes sense to me. It reconciles the apparent differences between geologic time, or orbital time, if you will, and the actual passage of time, the time that we would experience. Well, I guess that is orbital time, this is how poor I am at trying to explain this. The apparent differences between what we see in the fossil record and what we read in the chronicles, the history.
Well, in the fossil record, they date it by the sedimentary layers they're in, and the geologists date the sedimentary layers by where the fossils
are. Right. It's circular logic. Yeah,
it doesn't work. And it is young, because even in relative time since, well, like Garden of Eden time, you know, 4000 BC plus or minus a bit back there, and there is some argument that occurred at about 9 to 10,000 BC, but it doesn't matter, it's back there.
Mm-hmm.
But their calendar was a 360-day year, which meant that we were spinning as we went around the sun. Either we were closer, and as we spun, you know, we didn't turn as many times, or that the Earth was spinning at a different rate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it was spinning faster, it would mean that we would have more days in the year. If it was spinning slower, the other way around, which is a bit of a problem for us looking at the mathematics of it and the gravity, because when the Earth did that, it was smaller in diameter, and gravity increases.
Mm-hmm.
This is why the dinosaurs had to have such thick legs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, we've been battering this back and forth with low gravity, high gravity, whatever. But they had to have that to lift their bodies against gravity that was about 25 to 30% stronger than it is now. Because everything, all the mass was down there.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's expanded and formed cavities inside the Earth, and gravity is less per square meter.
Right.
So, and these all add to the argument that we've got to rethink this timing that the secular science says. It's not right.
Hmm.
And with these scientific arguments coming through, and showing that spontaneous radioactive decay, which is a function of speed of light, is controlled by this curve, that we're going to have to make that reality. And when we do, probably the Antichrist, with the help of Satan and his follow-ons who are going to be posing as aliens, they're going to underscore that and say, yes, that's right, we did that.
Yeah.
Watch for the deception, it's coming. And that's why, you know, this Antichrist that I'm talking about is so important, because I think he's going to come out of Saudi Arabia. And I think he's here and in the press today.
Mm. This is a fascinating discussion, and on several levels. First of all, it's exciting because we've got the prophecies to tell us that things are coming, but having read the end of the book, we know who wins.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, just as one who appreciates science, that we as Christians don't need to be intimidated by science or scientists. It is a tool to help us better understand God's creation. Fascinating stuff. Stan, your website for people who want to follow your work?
Standeo.com, StanDeyo.com. And when you see this, Holly will probably have started by that time doing her daily news updates and our commentaries on what's happening, how it fits in with prophecy. So we'll see you there.
All right. Always an education. Stan Dale, one of the 27 speakers at the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference. And in Colorado Springs, I'm Derek Gilbert. After spending about a decade in this little odd alternative Christian milieu that we inhabit, you get to a point where there's not much that surprises you anymore. But what I saw in the new DVD from our guest here was surprising, and really appreciate him sticking his neck out in the type of research that he's been doing. He is the executive producer, co-creator of the acclaimed Watchers series of DVDs, which received the People's Choice and Best Picture Award at the 2014 EBE Film Festival. And I'm assuming that was not a Christian film festival.
Not a Christian Christian venue, and it was incredible that we won it.
Yeah.
We were just blown away, and, you know, it was a real feather in our caps, as it were.
So, L.A. Marzulli, welcome. It's good to
great
see you
to
again.
Be here, Derek, yes.
Well, by the time this interview makes it to the public, both audio and video, it's we'll probably be into October by then.
Wow.
So we could keep that in mind as to how much you want to reveal here before you actually talk here today.
Okay.
You and your partner, business partner Richard Shaw, on Watchers 10, came up with something that was jaw-dropping. Josh Peck and I had the opportunity to watch the preview of Watchers 10, thanks to Richard, and It made the 3-hour layover in Atlanta feel like about 15 minutes. So, How much do you want to share about this and a backstory that you want to share with where you obtained the specimen that was featured in Watcher's Tent?
You're talking about the small specimen?
Yes.
Because there's lots of different specimens
featured. Yes.
All the way through.
Well, you did some really interesting DNA research on some of the skulls from Peru. And people are probably familiar with, if they're familiar with your work, the conical skulls.
Elongated skulls.
From Peru.
Right.
And there's some interesting results that came out of that testing. But then the small specimen was really, that was jaw-dropping.
Look, what we're going to talk about here seems sensationalistic, and I understand that. But isn't it sensationalistic to prophesy a virgin birth?
Yeah.
You know, or isn't it sensationalistic when we hail a savior who walks on water? I mean, how much more sensationalistic can you get? Because no one, except for Peter, has ever done it before or since, period, that we know about anyway. Rising from the dead, I mean, if that's not sensationalistic, I don't know what is. We were very, and we are, Richard's overly cautious. I have a tendency to want to, you know, pounce on it. But we're both, we have learned. We've done 10 films. I've written 10 books. We've learned to vet everything, trust no one, vet everything, and establish, if we can, a chain of evidence. So that's how we approach pretty much everything that we do. We have a hypothesis, which is the scientific method, specifically with the elongated skulls that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
The hypothesis was simply this, that we believe that there was a exodus from the Levant, from the Promised Land, about 3,500 years ago when Joshua and Caleb pushed into this area with the tribes of Israel, and they were given a mandate to wipe all the Nephilim tribes out there. And that in itself was a very curious passage because it speaks of genocide, and there's no way around that. And people like Richard Dawkins, premier evolutionist of the 20th and 21st century, will point to that exact scripture and accuse the God of the Bible as being a genocidal, maniacal, capricious God. And he's right, unless we factor in the Nephilim. Once we do, everything becomes very clear. And of course, the Nephilim are the byproduct of the unholy union between the fallen angelic hosts of heaven and the women of earth. Creates this entity that's in Milan. So as Joshua and Caleb go in, there seems to be a diaspora, an exodus, if you will. They flee. And it's been our hypothesis that if that's true, we should find evidence of that. The whole idea of the DNA evidence that we uncovered from five different skulls, four of them we were able to obtain DNA, is all in Watcher's Tent. It's also in the book, Nephilim Hybrids.
Mm-hmm.
When I use that term, Nephilim Hybrids, I use it very loosely. Frankly, I don't know what else to call these things. So it's just sort of a catch-all. You know, I don't know what they are. But it's pointing back to the biblical prophetic narrative and the veracity of that.
Mm.
And, you know, this is going to be in October. The beans will definitely be spilled well in advance of that. We're already doing radio shows. The testing, first of all, is not exhaustive. More testing needs to be done. We have not seen anything genetically which would indicate that it's non-human, but we've only been able to get mitochondrial DNA, which is from the woman, from the female line. And it's our hypothesis that more than likely, the mitochondrial DNA would be human, but the nuclear would not be. That's kind of what we're looking at, but even that is up for grabs. We don't know. And even though we're working with three different DNA labs, and I just only mentioned the one up in Canada that I'm allowed to mention, the other two are very well known. They don't want to be associated with us. So we've sort of given them, you know, our word that we will not tell anybody who we're dealing with. But we're dealing with three different DNA labs. The DNA evidence from all four of the skulls came back pointing to the mitochondrial DNA as originating from Europe and the Middle East. And folks, what's amazing about that, and what people need to understand, that at this point points to a history. We have to rewrite history.
Right. Even you know, regardless of the genetic composition, you know, just set aside, you know, whether the question of whether there's anything in there other than human, but the fact that you've got these skulls that date, what was the date?
This skull here dated about 2,000 years old. This is a replica of what we call the baby skull.
Right.
About 2,000 years old.
Okay, so we've got people in South America about the time of the birth of Christ who originated in Europe.
That's not supposed to be there.
Or the Middle East.
Correct.
Right, they're not supposed to be there. They were supposed to come across the land bridge.
Right.
from Russia into Alaska
the
and then down.
The Beringian land bridge.
Right.
And that's what's taught in evolutionary circles. If you're going to be a biologist or anything in the sciences, that's the paradigm that they all embrace. And they hold on to this paradigm tenaciously. So the scientific method says you have a hypothesis and then you begin to build and gather material and evidence to either support or completely blow your hypotheses out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
And if you blow it out of the water, then you rework your hypotheses and you go from there. So far, the hypothesis has been actually, all the evidence is pointing to the veracity of our hypotheses. And that makes us, skip for joy. It's not conclusive yet. We've got papers by geneticists, which are in the book. We refer to them in Watchers 10, but they're in verbatim in the book, so you can read them for yourselves. What's interesting is the fact that it's European ancestry, again, it rewrites history. It calls for a revision of the history that we know. Because Scotty Walper in his weekly series on the History Channel,
mm-hmm.
America on Earth, he says the history we've been taught is completely wrong. I'm paraphrasing, but he's right. There's a cover-up, and in my opinion, and this cover-up has everything to do with promulgating and holding up in a sacrosanct way the veracity and validity of the Darwinian paradigm, which I think is just a lot of hooey. And this points to European ancestry. It shouldn't be there. Now, here's the catch. A lot more testing needs to be done. We're not saying this is conclusive in any way, shape, or form. And, tonight when I get up and speak that, I'll make that very, very clear. We don't know. We still don't know what these entities were. But I'll give you another little teaser. An archaeologist came up to me, contacted me, had read my books, and this is an archaeologist who teaches archaeology, also anthropology. He's a degree credentialed, archaeologist. And he said, something's been overlooked in all of the testing. I go, what do you mean? Because we've had other archaeologists look at this and medical doctors, and he talked about the foramen magnum. The foramen magnum is located here, basically at the base of the skull. That's where the foramen magnum is located. The spinal column comes up like this and connects to the foramen magnum.
Mm-hmm.
We all have one, everybody, every human being on this planet. And so it was his hypothesis that the foramen magnum in these skulls was different. And I sent him three casts that I have, plus pictures of that Joe Taylor, who made the casts. When Joe does a cast, he flips the skull over like this before he does anything. Click, 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 click. So we had all those pictures.
Mm-hmm.
We sent it to the archaeologist plus the casts. And what was astounding, he said, and he's looked at literally thousands of skulls and read reports. The positioning of the foramen magnum in these Paraca skulls, not only is it in a different location, but it's of a different shape. And I don't have time to get into all this tonight in my presentation.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I could. But it's what it's basically doing is it's forcing a normal human being, the foramen magnum, let's say it would be here.
Mm-hmm.
These foramen magnum are towards the back. This is called the occipital plate. The back of the skull is where, so it's moved. Well, that's from cradle headboarding. Not so fast. You can cradle board a head. We get that. You can cradle board a head and elongate that head. But you can't move the position of the foramen magnum.
Right.
And back on the skull. You just can't do that. And so what's incredible about this is he wrote a paper. It's in the book, Nephilim Hybrid. It's also in Watchers 10, verbatim. And what's incredible about it, it's once again, it seems to point back to the veracity of our hypothesis. Here's one more kicker. We gave this to a woman, Marcia Moore,
mm-hmm.
who's a forensic artist. We gave his information, and we said, what do you think this thing would look like? And she said, well, based on the location of where the foramen magnum is, I would posit that the necks would be abnormally long on these people.
Ah.
Now she has no Nephilim dog in the hunt at all. Zero Nephilim dog in the hunt.
Uh-huh.
That's why we call the book Nephilim Hybrids, okay? Zero Nephilim dog in the hunt, and she states on the record, and she draws it. It makes a forensic rendition of what this would look like, that the neck would be much longer. And at this point, I tell her, are you aware of who the Anakim are? No, I never heard that word. The Anakim is a word that we hear in the account when Joshua and Caleb go into the promised land where the Nephilim tribes are, and the Anakim are one of the Nephilim tribes, and the Anakim, when you translate it, means long necks.
Right.
And I'm not making this up. So here we have a forensic artist who has no Nephilim dog in the hunt, secular woman, but she's like, what are these, you know, what's going on? Here's and this is all 2016 research. Here's what's going on with this particular artifact, these skulls, from the archaeologist, puts two and two together, and this, look, there are whole skeletons still to be found down there. No one's ever assembled, that I'm aware of, and looked at all this stuff. But now that we know, we're learning as we go. And Father God, you know, seems to be bringing either artifacts or people to us. It's amazing. He's got his hand all over this thing, and that, of course, makes us really excited.
You know, this is phenomenal stuff. And I've said before, and I'll put it on the record here again, that it was your novel, the first of the Nephilim trilogy, where I first encountered the word outside of Genesis 6. Mm-hmm. And the only reason I went looking for a book about the Nephilim was because I, at the age of 35, finally attended a church where somebody, an evangelist, mentioned Genesis 6 verses 1 through 4 in a church setting. And your novel was the only book in that particular branch of the St. Louis County Library that made a reference to. And so that was my first experience in digging deeper into the subject. So you brought me on this strange journey. And we haven't even gotten to the small artifact, the small sample, but we'll have to leave that for the people who've watched the live stream or are watching the DVD set. But phenomenal stuff. L.A. Marzulli, where do people follow you, follow your blog, follow your broadcast?
They can go to lamarzulli.net, lamarzulli.net, also ppsreport.com, ppsreport.com, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural Report.com. That's our TV show. We're also on Roku, same name, PPS Report, also our YouTube channel, L.A. Marzulli. So, you know, we're all over the place, and our YouTube channel is growing leaps and bounds, and we're really excited by that.
L.A., looking forward to seeing the presentation.
Can't wait. Thanks, Derek, for having me.
And thank you for watching from the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference. I'm Derek Gilbert.
Links to both of their sites will be in the show notes at vftb.net, and, of course, if you're watching this on video, at in the notes below the video at youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. And by the way, while you're watching, if you are watching on video, take a moment, click that little red button in the bottom right-hand corner that says subscribe, please. That way you'll get an email every time something new on the YouTube channel updates. Not only these video versions of A View from the Bunker, but the weekly releases and the ongoing audio series for my novel, The God Conspiracy, released new every Monday. We're up to episode 7 now. A couple of comments on L.A. Marzulli's presentation. Obviously, you know now, since the conference in July, that the so-called demon fairy or winged nightmare that L.A. presented at the conference or gave his presentation on, he didn't actually have possession of it in July, it has been determined to be a fake. L.A. and Richard Shaw got possession of it from Jaime Maussan, the Mexican television presenter and ufologist, not long ago, in September. And as they took it to a couple of veterinarians for examination, there under the up-close examination became pretty obvious that the thing was a creation. Somebody apparently took a couple of bats and maybe some pieces from other animals and cobbled them together in a very skillful fashion, the kind of thing that a taxidermist or somebody with knowledge of animal physiology would have done. Put a lot of time into it. According to one of the experts who looked at it, they estimated about 40 hours worth of work in putting it together. But in fact, I'll put a link in the show notes as well to the interview we got with L.A. Marzulli for Skywatch TV the day after he discovered that it was, in fact, a fraud, that somebody had fooled Jaime Maussan, fooled the first veterinarians who had looked at the x-rays. It under better x-rays and, of course, actually being able to get their hands on it, they were able to tell that the thing was not real. They're working on now a book and video presentation on what they're calling the anatomy of a hoax. In the news this week, it is almost as though we're looking at a slow motion train wreck in a couple of ways. I'm not going to talk politics because, frankly, I'm getting sick of it. And if you talk about one candidate or the other these days, especially if you're a Christian, The group supporting the other side believes that you're working for the Antichrist. So we'll just set that to the side. The level to which this campaign has sunk is startling, but we really shouldn't be surprised. Hillary Clinton wants to win at all costs, and Donald Trump is a fighter. He doesn't like to lose either. But if we go back and look at history, we tend to forget from election to election how nasty things get, even when you're dealing with somebody relatively clean cut with, say, a Mitt Romney. You know, there are things that come out that just make you shake your head. Why would anybody in their right mind? In fact, I had a college professor ask this one day in a course on the American presidency more than 30 years ago. So bear in mind, before the internet and internet journalism, said, why would anyone in their right mind? I think, no, I actually put it as a declaration. No one in their right mind would subject himself or herself or their families to the kind of scrutiny you have to endure to run for high office in the United States. And again, this was before the invention of the internet. And he was right. And of course, the logical conclusion then is that the only people who run for president of the United States are clinically insane. So we get what we deserve. And God allows it. So don't get too freaked out. I find myself getting drawn into it because I've been a political junkie a long time. And I've got pretty strong feelings about the foreign policy of Hillary Clinton. Her beliefs and those like her are responsible for, I believe, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of deaths in Libya, Syria, and Iraq. And if she is elected, I have no doubt that we will come very, very close to war with Russia, if not outright war. That's what she wants. And so while Donald Trump's behavior is nothing I would hold up as exemplary, the fact that he's at least talking with Vladimir Putin instead of declaring that we're going to impose a no-fly zone over Syria, which even the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff says amounts to an act of war against Russia. You can guess which way I'm leaning. Anyway, in the news this week, the USS Mason, which is a guided missile destroyer, has been fired on by Iran-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen twice, Sunday night and again Wednesday night. After the second attack, the Navy launched missiles against the radar installations on the Yemeni coast that were used to target the Mason. No injuries, no damage to the ship. The Mason fired anti-missile missiles. It's not clear whether they knocked down the incoming or whether the missiles fired by the Houthi rebels just were badly aimed. We don't know. But apparently this was the first use of this particular anti-missile missile by the U.S. Navy. So it's kind of a big deal. So the Navy might not say, even if they actually know what took place. Kind of a secondary story here, but kind of also important, is that the intelligence services of Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the United States missed a big shipment of missiles from Iran to these rebels in Yemen. Not just these anti-ship missiles that have about a 75-mile range, which means that if they really try, they could target anything sailing through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, which is the little strait, the narrow strait at the southern end of the Red Sea, which connects the Red Sea to the Indian Ocean. And about a third of the oil exports from the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia sail out through that strait. Now, the Saudis and the Iranians don't get along. You've got the major Sunni power and the major Shia power in the world at odds with one another, basically fighting a proxy war in Syria right now, but another one in Yemen, where the Saudi military, along with its allies from the Gulf, the UAE, Egypt, and others, going after these Iran-backed rebels. So things could get really dicey. The UAE has a Navy base that it's opened up in Eritrea, within range of these anti-ship missiles. But more than that, the Iranians apparently also provided Scud-D surface-to-surface missiles, which have a range of about 500 miles. So things are a little dicey there. But more than that, Russia is reading a lot of the signals that they're getting from the American political campaign right now Not one party or the other, but both parties. There is a bifactional war party that supports Democrat or Republican, depending on who will continue their war. Hillary Clinton Sunday night in the debate called for that no-fly zone, but the call is also coming from hawks on the right. Put that in air quotes. Lindsey Graham, John McCain, others, even Vice President Mike Pence, or Vice Presidential candidate, rather, Mike Pence, whom Donald Trump has said he disagrees with on this particular issue. Intervening in Syria, again, essentially means going to war with Russia. And frankly, I don't see how it's in the interests of the American people to fight a war with another nuclear power. The only, well, one of the only other global nuclear powers on the planet over Syria. That just doesn't make any sense. And yet the neocons are ready to do it. Russia's top propagandist, a gentleman who was picked by Vladimir Putin to head up the government-owned news agency in Moscow, Dmitry Kiselyov, said this past Monday that impudent behavior by the United States would have nuclear implications. Russia also, by the way, is negotiating with Egypt to gain access to military base there, and is also reportedly in talks with Vietnam and Cuba, interestingly enough, about military bases in those places. Now, Cuba may not be willing to risk the new relationship that it is developing with the United States. They want to get out from under the sanctions that they've been under since the, since Castro took power more than 50 years ago. They may not want to risk the possibility that their economy may benefit from relations with America again by welcoming the Russians. And they can't count on Russia to bankroll Cuba like they did during the early years of the Cold War in the, 60s. So we'll see what happens there. But it is interesting. The Russians also trying to get a naval base in Kamran Bay, which is a strategic place in the South China Sea. So we shall see. But when politicians here at home talk tough to please the home crowd, and I get why it would. I mean, if you're my age or older, Russia still in the back of your mind is the bad guy. The folks in Moscow are listening, and they're taking this tough talk seriously. Back to the South China Sea, by the way, for a minute. South Korea is now saying it's going to shoot Chinese fishing boats that enter its waters and fish illegally. They've had a couple incidents there over the last couple of weeks that hadn't gotten much press over here, but they really should. A couple of weeks ago, Chinese Coast Guard intercepted a Chinese fishing vessel, and the Coast Guard officers tossed a couple of flash grenades onto the Chinese boat, which set the cabin on fire, and three fishermen died. So late last week, South Korean Coast Guard intercepted a couple more Chinese fishing boats in South Korean waters. They were on board one of the vessels investigating when the other Chinese fishing boat rammed the Coast Guard boat from behind, and it sank. So South Korea announced Tuesday that they've authorized the use of handguns and onboard cannon to shoot Chinese fishing vessels. The killer clown craze has not yet jumped the shark, but it has jumped the ocean. It is manifesting now in the UK. 59 reports alone in Kent, which is southeast England, in Northumbria, which is northeast England. Officials are telling costume shops, don't sell or rent clown costumes. Apparently, it's getting out of hand. There were three incidents in London, according to Scotland Yard, that they considered criminal attacks. In fact, one guy at an ATM was sliced to the bone on his hand, going to leave him with a permanent disability, by a clown carrying a knife. So it's not funny. And frankly, I think taking something intended as entertainment for children and turning it into something evil, dangerous, I think it's demonic. I think it's demonic, and I'm not trying to exaggerate or be sensational. I think there's something demonic behind it. There are other stuff here, but mainly stuff that we already covered in Sci Friday this week. So encourage you to check out Sci Friday at the Skywatch TV channel on Roku or on YouTube. Talking about the transhumanism this week and some of the aspects of transhumanism, where you've got atheistic transhumanists saying that there's still room for spirituality in the transhuman movement. Well, The ironic thing is that we're all transhuman. We are all someday going to get an upgrade, those of us who believe in Jesus Christ. We're getting an upgrade. I know we don't often hear it preached in church, but the resurrection is a key part of Christian doctrine. As Paul wrote to the church at Corinth, 1 Corinthians, that if there is no resurrection, then Christ himself is not raised. And if he is not raised from the dead, then we're still in our sins. And if our hope is in this life only, we are most miserable of men. Sadly, that kind of describes the transhumanists. And what they're trying to create, and they don't realize this. I mean, one of the articles we looked at quoted Max Moore, who's one of the leaders, one of the biggest known, best names, most influential thinkers in the transhumanist movement, that we who believe in Christ, anyone really with a religious worldview, that he kind of characterized our belief system as believing that this world is kind of nasty and dirty, and we just have to kind of wait this out until we can get to the good place, which is heaven. And he thinks that's kind of defeatist, apparently, that we should do whatever we can to create heaven on earth. Well, we are called to help our fellow men, to assist widows and orphans, our elders. But the problem is the human heart. We will never fix the problem completely and create heaven on earth because the human heart is inherently selfish and wicked. And you can't fix that with a silicon chip. Transhumanists haven't recognized that yet. Sadly, what they want to do is extend our lives to the point of immortality. And when you've got a bunch of people who live eternally with unregenerate hearts, to me that sounds like hell, not heaven. Coming up in A View from the Bunker, Carl Gallups has got a new book out about the fulfillment of prophecy in these days. As we see these headlines around us, clearly something significant is going on. It's almost mind-numbing how quickly things are changing and the things that are changing, which are historic. When the Lion Roars is the name of his new book, and that is the interview that you will hear Sunday, the 16th. Next, the following week, the 23rd, still got to confirm and get him out here actually to sit down, but the plan is to have Trey Smith, filmmaker Trey Smith, the God in a Nutshell project, here on A View from the Bunker. And then on October 30th, something that's become sort of a tradition on A View from the Bunker, Dr. Judd Burton, author of Interview with the Giant, Ethnohistorical Notes on the Nephilim. He's got a new book just about ready to come out on vampires. So very timely discussion this year with Dr. Burton. Those are the upcoming programs here on A View from the Bunker. And we got a few others in the works that we'll confirm here in the weeks ahead. Our weekly Bible study continues every Sunday, gilberthouse.org, the Gilbert House Fellowship, an hour each of the Old Testament and the New Testament. We'll have those uploaded and available for your download by midday Sunday. Again, that's at gilberthouse.org. And on Mondays, a new episode every week, while they last, of The God Conspiracy, my novel, done in audio form. We're releasing that through YouTube. You can go directly to this address. We'll get you to that particular playlist, thegodconspiracy.tk, thegodconspiracy, all one word, .tk. And of course, if you subscribe to the YouTube channel, you'll get a notice by email every time a new episode is released. The YouTube channel, youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. Skywatch TV, coming up next week, we talk to Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis. Is that right? Is he next on the schedule? Well, interesting. Gary Haven. An update on the new film, Armageddon, as that is just about ready for release on DVD and Blu-ray. Film had its theatrical run, now available for you to watch at home. An interesting film, and Gary Haven, an interesting guy. Very astute, very politically aware, and he's right when it comes to being prepared, because there are things out there that, you know, you can't predict. Doesn't necessarily have to be an EMP knocking out the electric grid. There are plenty of other things, as Hurricane Matthew kind of makes very, very evident, that can change your life in a hurry, and it's best to be prepared. That will be next week's program on Skywatch TV. We appreciate your reviews and your ratings at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you download A View from the Bunker. And of course, I'll say again, we're available now on YouTube as well, youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. You like the page? like the program, like the page at Facebook. Facebook.com/viewfromthebunker, available on Twitter as well at viewfrombunker. You'll find those links at the website, vftb.net. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.